A senator running for governor, a Peabody Award-winning reporter, an activist, and the mother of a famous actor walk into a bar. Now, wait. No, they're going to actually join me for an action-packed show about education. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From the Tennessean, Betsy DeVos warns teachers' unions, "I'm not going anywhere. In fact, I'm just getting started." During a speech in Nashville on Thursday, U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos called for education reform groups to continue the fight for school choice and said rumors of her departure are false.
Well, I guess we have to retract our news from a couple weeks ago then, where we were reporting that Betsy DeVos was on her way out.
Good thing we can go back and do that, right?
So we were contributing to fake news
yes.
here at Busted Pencils.
Hey, I feel like part of the crowd.
Well, then this is well. So she's not going anywhere. She's and in fact, I actually when it was put out there that she was talking about or people were rumoring that she was on her way out, it made no sense to me other than the fact that this isn't a qualified person for the job, and so I could see why she might want to go. However, her ideological stance what she wants to do, mm-hmm. She can't leave. This is the dream position.
She's not going anywhere.
She purchased this position legitimately, man.
paid for it.
She is going to go out there. And so here you go right away. And she's like, look, unions, I have not even started. Rumors of my death are very premature,
yeah.
And I'm coming after you guys. School choice, you name it. You know, we've got to get out there. So, yeah, Betsy is going to be on the payroll for the tax or the citizen,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. For the taxpayer for a long
time now to come, mm-hmm. and she's got a lot more work to do. So. You know, short little news story here, but let's just remind everybody that sometimes news that's fake is premature.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, post Act 10 teacher workforce stabilizes, but exodus of younger teachers troubling, a study says. 7 years after the passage of Act 10, the Wisconsin collective bargaining law, many blame for the exodus of public school teachers that followed. The teacher workforce appears to be stabilizing in Milwaukee and across the state, a new study has found.
So I'm confused by the headline. Is there an exodus or has the workforce stabilized? Right?
I don't know,
but you get deep into here. What I want to say is that I'm a bit offended by this piece. I call plagiarism because
yeah.
I've been calling it a teacher exodus for well over 2.5, almost 3 years now.
I've heard you say that.
Yeah. I've been saying that, mm-hmm. but it takes a study to actually call it an exodus.
Because you should have done a study.
Prior to this, we were calling it a teacher shortage.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you are concerned as to whether or not there was truly a link to Act 10
right.
and the exodus. And, you know, that's a valid point because I can say that actually the teacher shortage that is an exodus, and in fact, they now use that word.
Yeah, they do.
Is across the country in places where they don't have Act 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you have to look at Act 10, though, from the point of view of what it was. Act 10, from the point of view of teachers, was seen as just one more thing against them. And so when we look at the world of teaching as a profession, accountability, high-stakes testing, holding them accountable for kids' test scores, making sure that they had to, you know, losing recess, losing all of these things, but then blaming the teachers for the, quote, achievement gap when politicians were defunding them at the exact same time, right? Mm-hmm. So it was just a contributing factor to an all-out sense of feeling like, wow, no one likes me as a teacher. And so when we look at that, the contribution of, and I've called it, in fact, 2.5 years ago, go back to one of my original blog posts on Busted Pencils, it's a war on teachers. We've had a war on teachers nationally. Act 10 is a small part of that war in Wisconsin, but there's a larger war that has caused an exodus. And so what's important about this study is that we finally get to, despite the fact that Busted Pencils has been calling it an exodus for the last 2.5 years, mm-hmm. we can now officially say that the teachers that aren't in the classrooms, it's not a shortage. It's because they're leaving. That's an exodus.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Teacher exodus is finally not fake news. Hey, breaking news from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, as we just heard in the news segment, but it's now been released in a report. And Wisconsin, guess what? We have a teacher leaving problem. Hey, let me start with this quote from Ann Chapman, senior researcher at the forum and lead author of the study. Here's what she says, quote, "If you address the reasons we have these vacancies in the first place, you may alleviate the sense of urgency about getting people into the classrooms. Can I call plagiarism? How many Busted Pencils blogs have I written over the last 2.5 years that stated the problem to the teacher shortage was a leaving problem?" Well, here are some quotes over the past few years. How about this one? "However, let's be honest, we don't have a teacher shortage. We have an exceedingly high casualty rate from the war on teachers. In other words, the last 30 years and the war on teachers have decimated the ranks of teachers." That was from 2 years ago. How about this quote? "When teachers are leaving their jobs across the state and enrollment in teacher prep programs is at an all-time low, you don't have a labor shortage. You have a toxic workplace environment, a toxicity that has spurred an exodus from the classrooms of our children and a plummeting enrollment in teacher preparation programs." Hey, but the report gets better. According to the study, quote, "The departure of teachers in their 20s, 30s, and 40s is growing steadily and accounts for the largest share of teacher turnover, a trend that over time could put greater pressure on teacher demand than that already created by the exodus." Look, don't get me wrong. I appreciate the study's findings. However, why does it take a study to verify the simple observations that the dismal morale reported by teachers all over social media has led to a mass exodus of public school classrooms? Is it real news now? Were mine fake? Maybe the better question is, if you scream teacher exodus in the woods and nobody hears it, does a study reported in the newspaper about teacher retention serve a better purpose than toilet paper while you're in the woods?
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Teachers are leaving the profession. Competency-based teacher education, which is a fancy way to say let's not make our teachers have or get an education, has been offered up as a possible solution. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would think about that.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Nancy, we've got a shortage of teachers, and one of the ways to get there is to get away from traditional teacher education, and we should use competency-based teacher education.
Yes, this is a very interesting topic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you might be able to design alternatives to the typical teacher education program that were really excellent, that were competency-based. It's in the realm of possibility, but you would have to, the professional teachers would have to design it. I don't know who designed this program that is actually in my state of Massachusetts at
right.
MIT in Woodrow Wilson Academy, but it makes me very nervous to read about it, what I could see in the article, because it said they have to show mastery in, and the first thing they said was defining and measuring learning outcomes.
Right. There we
now,
go. I mean, that's
there we go.
Right.
So,
I looked right at it and went, okay, boom, test scores.
Test scores. So if you're going to define competency the way it's been defined by federal U.S. policies for the last 15 years, that would be very scary because you would be focusing the learner, the teacher-learner person, on all the wrong things, tests and accountability and how to disseminate information the way we were talking about earlier, how to just give know what standards are and impart them as if the child's just a passive recipient, and not knowing anything about the teaching and learning process, or of great importance, not knowing anything about learners and how they learn.
Yeah, but according to this, though, they will be able to use virtual reality to look at learners.
What do you mean?
Well, according to back to the, you know, we've had discussions about personalized learning and technology, but technology, we can watch animations through a virtual reality goggle, and we can interact with robotic or, I don't know, what's computer-based students and figure out if we give them the right, I don't know, it's a weird thing, but we've been hearing about this in teacher education, the idea that, look, we can simulate through a computer program classroom situations and then have teachers make decisions, and then that is a way to evaluate their effectiveness.
I think it's missing the critical central dimension of education, teaching, and learning, which is that it's human. And that it really centers on relationships between teachers and students and among students. And that what gets learned, the content is very important, but what gets learned is going to be shaped by the human beings who are engaged in teaching and learning. And you can't ever predict that, which is what all this computer stuff is trying to do.
Well, and that is part of the problem. The other thing here that I'm not real convinced, and again, this is in Inside Higher Ed, they talk about, you know, this can sound like a positive. Look, you don't get out until you're ready. And in fact, the quote is, there's nothing here that says in 2 years you'll have your master's degree or 36 hours means you're ready to be a teacher. You actually have to prove it. But in that also kind of, for me, is like, okay, so there's an end point in which I can now say I'm a teacher and learning stops to be a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I think it's very worrisome to focus on competencies, especially if they're defined the way people seem to be embarking on this idea, because I think it isn't just competencies that teachers need. They need knowledge, and they need self-awareness, and they need to have experiences in some form where they're looking at themselves, their interactions, they're looking at culture and language, they're looking at human development. You know, there are many dimensions to being really a prepared educator that wouldn't be defined by this narrow idea competency, which implies it's just something you can do. I'm talking about all the things you need to know.
Right. And then that's where we worry about competency, you know, but is there something positive we might want to look at? I do appreciate the time where they do say that they're spending a lot of time in clinical practice.
Yeah.
And that should be applauded as long as it's a real clinical practice with real kids in real classrooms.
There's a model in Boston that I think is very good. It's in early childhood. They have Boston is a huge school system, very diverse, urban, and the early childhood system within the Boston Public Schools has developed this extensive mentoring coaching system. And I know a lot of these coaches because they actually went through the master's program at Lesley University where I taught, and they're extremely high-level, great human beings and good early childhood professionals. They're out there in classrooms working with teachers in a very hands-on and long-term way, working with early childhood teachers and doing tons of professional development in a coaching kind of way as well as periodically in classrooms. And I've talked with them about this idea of, do you think there could be an alternative to a master's degree? Because I usually say every educator should get a master's degree like they do in Finland. And they've convinced me. I think it's true that you could have an alternative to going to a teacher education program in a college or university. And you could get a very good preparation, but I think it needs to be driven by the profession.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
He began his career as an education reporter with National Public Radio in 1974. Since 1984, he has worked in public television as education correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. His work has been recognized with Peabody Awards, Emmy nominations, and in 2012, he became the first journalist to be honored with the prestigious McGraw Prize in Education. And he has a new book titled Addicted to Reform, a 12-step program to rescue public education. Welcome to Busted Pencils, the John Merrow.
Thank you. I wish my mom were around to hear those that you said.
Well, I mean, that's a heck of a career. You've been doing education reporting and stuff since 1974, and you've seen a lot. You've been there. And I just appreciate the work that you've done and talking about being able to really look at things. And so what I want to do, though, is I want to hit specifically on the blog that you just released about the D.C. reform, and then later we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about your new book, too. And we could probably talk for 3 days about everything that you've done, but, you know, for the brevity here. But, you know, in your blog, themerroreport.com, it's the D.C. school reform fiasco, a complete history. And we've talked, you and I, on my old podcast about some of the things that went wrong with D.C., but here you lay it out, and you kind of lay it out under what are seven issues: dismal academic performance, swollen bureaucracy, an exodus of teachers and mid-year resignations, revolving door for principals, sluggish enrollment, misleading graduation statistics, and widespread cheating by adults. Now, we could get into every single one of these, and I know that they are there, but I want to go back into where I think it's really hard and it's been tough to make this, where people will listen. But cheating, there was cheating in D.C.
Absolutely, yeah, by adults.
By adults. I mean, so tell us, I mean, when you say cheating, like, what happened? How did
Well, let me say that this is not a D.C. story. This is more than a D.C. story, Tim. The reason I spent so much time on it is that the so-called the education reformers, which I believe are doing a lot of damage to public education, hold up Washington as a great success story.
Right.
And they say, let's replicate what they've done in D.C. And, of course, what they did in D.C. was they sort of worshipped at the temple of the test score, and they set up what is essentially a test and punish system which held teachers accountable for the scores of kids on a test that meant nothing to kids. Mm. And that was essentially the greatest determinant of whether those teachers got fired or rehired. So it's a story that's of much more importance than Washington, D.C., because it's happening in so many places around the country, and it's really hurting, not only hurting a lot of kids, it's hurting the profession, it's hurting the it's this faux reform that I write about in my book, Addicted to Reform. But on the question of cheating, sure. The way D.C. had set it up was the test was given to the principals, the test booklets were given to distributed to the principals about a week before the tests were given. And the principals knew that the results of those tests would determine their future. Well, that's a little bit like what the Catholic Church calls an occasion of sin. You know, you're putting temptation in front of these men and women, and some of them succumbed. Some right. of them opened the booklet. Some of them maybe gave a booklet to another teacher. There were stories, credible stories, about erasure parties later on. Mm-hmm. This was nailed down in Atlanta. It wasn't nailed down in Washington, unfortunately, because Atlanta has a strong central government and D.C. does not. And Atlanta has a strong newspaper, which hadn't taken sides in education, whereas the Washington Post was helplessly on the side of Michelle Rhee and Kaya Henderson, the chancellor.
Right. I wanted to introduce that and make sure that everybody recognizes and remembers. We're talking about the beginning here when Michelle Rhee and Kaya Henderson came in and they set up this, as you said, a kind of test and punish regime. But then the conclusion of this regime was these false inflated test scores that sadly became a model for the nation.
And Tim, could I just add one thing?
Sure.
This continues.
Right.
this summer, NPR aired a story about Ballou High School, a school which had a 57% graduation rate, which suddenly had a 100% graduation rate with every student going to college. Well, the reporters were not appropriately skeptical. You know, when something sounds too good to be true, it probably is not true.
Right.
Subsequent reporting revealed that the graduation rate would have stayed at about 57% had the adults not intervened and changed grades for kids helped them on exams, actually filled out the college applications for them because they didn't want to go to college. So some kids had missed 60 to 90 days of school. It's a 180-day school year.
Wow.
And yet they, and the school rules were if you miss 15 days, you flunk the class. Yet they were, they passed the class. So I'm, this is the same, this is the proof of Campbell's law, that the
right.
more weight you put on a single measure, the greater the probability that that measure will be distorted and prostituted. So it continues in D.C., which is why it's an important story.
Yeah, I, and in fact, that's why, I mean, we go back to it. But what's more discouraging, disheartening, and I'm sure to you especially, though, is the continued pointing to D.C. And when we talk about accountability, the lack of accountability to hold those accountable who put in motion this false narrative of a successful school reform movement.
Well, yes, there has not been any accountability because so many people have gone out on this limb saying, let's celebrate. I mean, certain Secretary Arne Duncan did, the authors of No Child Left Behind did, an awful lot of people have said, oh, this is a great success. Well, it's not only not a great success, it's actually a huge failure. An awful lot of kids have been lied to. And when you get a phony diploma, you go out there with your high school diploma and you really don't know much. Well, suppose somebody employs you and then discovers, hey, you've got a high school diploma, but you don't know anything. Then you're going to say, well, I guess I better not hire any more kids from Washington, D.C. So it becomes a brush that tars an awful lot of people. Or since most of the kids are non-white, that employer might say, well, I probably shouldn't hire any more non-white kids. So, I mean, there's a lot at stake here. In fundamental fairness. You see, Tim, what the schools do generally, and I write about this in the book, is in D.C. is to the max, but they look at a kid and say, how smart are you? And they give you a test. Well, what we have to do is create schools which look at a kid and say, how are you smart? And operate from and start from there. In D.C., they simply reduce kids to a test score. How smart are you on this one test? Test is a photograph, and school is a film.
Right. As you said, though, I mean, the test score, achievement around test scores, though, of driving reform, I don't see that much let up anywhere I look, even after all of this cheating and all of these debacles. And in fact, when we look at, quote, even if we want to say about real learning, and if we give test scores their due and say, look, they're a snapshot in time of a moment in time that show us something about that moment in time, and that's about it. But we still are driving reform around, quote, the achievement gap, and yes, that
exactly.
gap
yeah.
is typically illustrated by test scores, correct?
Right. Yes. And the best way to talk about that with white parents or white people anyway is to say, you know, we have to do something about this white Asian achievement gap. These Asian kids are just doing these. We have to get tougher on these white kids. Let's cut recess for white kids. Let's
right.
cut art for white kids. Let's cut music for white kids. Let's cut science for white kids. Let's do test prep for white kids until they catch up with the Asian kids. Well, if that did in fact happen, that would be a real wake-up call, and white people would say, wait, maybe we're doing this wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we have is an opportunity gap. We have an expectations gap. And of course, you end up with differences in outcomes. But the solution is not test prep and drill and kill and all that sort of thing.
Well, that's
it's to create the kind of schools
right.
we want to send our own kids and grandkids to.
What's the 12-step program?
Well, it of course is modeled after AA, and with all respect. And the first step in any addiction program is to recognize the problem, to acknowledge the addiction. And I think there's an easy way to do that, I think, to recognize that we become addicted to superficial reform. We attack the symptoms of a problem, work like crazy, and a lot of good people working on it, mm-hmm. and seem to fix it and then move on to something else. And I don't fault the people who are trying to improve the system because many of them are my friends, and I admire most of them who are actually working to make a difference. The problem is we're not attacking the real problem. Take dropout, the graduation rate. Mm-hmm. That was a signature effort in the Obama administration. And sure enough, the graduation rate went from about 70% to, I think, 82% nationally. Four things happened, Tim, only one of which was good. The good one was people came in and tutored. They'd say, John needs some help in math, and some people would give John the help, and then I would be able to pass the test and I would graduate. That's good.
That sure, we've got no problem with extra help in helping students.
Not a bit. Right. That helped improve the graduation rate. The other three things that happened, however, one is called credit recovery, mm-hmm. which is a giant scam where a kid goes into a room and sits in front of a computer for about a week, answering prompts, hitting buttons, and gets a semester's worth of credit. Virtually every school district in the country relied on credit recovery to get kids through. Some districts, 25-30% of kids were getting from credit recovery. So that raised the graduation rate. Another thing that happened to him is that school authorities would say to kids who were in trouble, on the bubble, they say, you know, John, I think you really would benefit from a GED. You know, there's a GED enrollment center just four blocks down the street. Why don't you go down, sign up for a GED? It'd be a lot easier to get your high school diploma. So I'd say, oh, okay. And I'd walk out of school. Well, I wasn't a dropout.
Right. Oh.
So the graduation rate was going to go up.
Right.
Now, did the school make sure that I signed up? No. In most cases, they did not.
Okay.
And the third bad thing that happened to increase the graduation rate was something we talked about in the last segment, cheating, changing grades, erase your parties on tests so that kids passed their courses. So that's the superficial reform. They didn't attack a problem. They attacked the symptom of a problem, the low graduation rate. So one of the 12 steps is to acknowledge the addiction. There are others, though, Tim.
I want to interject. So admitting the problem, and I just want to throw this out there and see where you'll go with it. I think I'm not as forgiving as you are on saying that some people are doing good work and think they're doing good work. I think there are, but I see too much of the reform movement as a system that proves public schools fail. And in fact, we know it does, because if we use test scores as that metric, and let's go back to what you talked about, let's not talk about the achievement gap, but what causes the achievement gap, which mm-hmm. is the opportunity gap. If we do not provide any resources towards those opportunity issues, and we continue to use test scores as the metric, aren't we just creating a system that is always going to produce failure?
Yes, absolutely correct. And I agree with you that some of the people involved in this do have nefarious motives. Okay. They want to make money. They want to, for ideological reasons, they want to tear down public education. There's no question about that.
Okay.
But there are an awful lot of well-meaning people
sure.
who want to help kids.
Okay.
So we need to harness their energy. And actually, one of the 12 steps is to embrace outsiders. Because, 75 to 80% of households do not have school-age children. So those people, those 75, and a lot of them vote, they need to know what good things are happening in public schools, and a lot of good things are happening. Another step is to measure what matters. Right now, we value what we measure. Instead, we need to measure what we value.
Okay.
But that requires a conversation. Now, here's my argument, Tim, is that if we said to school people, here's one thing we're counting. How many hours of art and music do you have every week? Well, school people at principal aren't stupid. They know that a big number is better than a low number.
Right.
How many hours of recess do you have? Again, they'd figure out
right.
that. If you said, what's your teacher turnover rate?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you don't do that in a gotcha way. But, if the school that I'm running has a 30% turnover rate, and the school you're running has a 5%, well, the school superintendent might say, hey, John, have a cup of coffee with Tim.
Right.
Go over there. I mean, in other words, it shouldn't be a gotcha game. We should, instead of testing to punish, we should be assessing to improve.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be a gotcha game. The folks who build highways, They build highways with the intent of getting you from point A to point B. And so the highway is not 1 inch wider than a car. It's 4 or 5 feet wider than a car. So if you veer off, you aren't automatically in an accident. You need that mentality in building schools. There has to be room for failure. Has to be room for going off course, because the goal has to be to get the kid to the place where he or she belongs. Again, by asking that question, how are you smart? Not how smart are you?
Well, and how are you smart? And just as we kind of come up here on this, I got a last question, and we'll conclude here. But is this where you start talking about having students be more of what might be called knowledge creators?
Yes, absolutely correct. And I do hope people will read Addicted to Reform. I've got a bunch of examples there where the old model of school is that teachers are the workers and the kids are the product. I think that's absolutely wrong. I think the kids are the workers and knowledge is the product. And so I'm a huge believer in group projects, but they have to be genuine projects where the kids are in fact learning stuff, discovering stuff. And I've got a bunch of examples. I know we don't have time to go into them, but if you think about that idea, then the teacher becomes management, actually. But kids are the workers, and they are actually, there's so much. See, the kids are swimming in a sea of information 24/7, but information is not knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so it's the job of the adults to help kids learn to ask skeptical questions, to
right.
figure out what's true. Just because they saw it on the internet doesn't make it true.
Right.
What do you know? How do you know what you know?
You're not
making kids cynics. You're making them skeptics.
Right. How do you put all this information together? It sounds very close to a lot of what I think Marion Brady has been trying to push for the last 25, 30 years about knowledge.
And I would say, Tim, that I'm not an original thinker. I wish I were. But I have tried to pull together what I've observed in 41 years of reporting. I mean, I think, with technology, parents throw up their hands and say, oh, the kids are digital natives. We're just visitors. Well, maybe they're digital natives, but they are not digital citizens.
Right.
It's our job as adults to turn those digital natives into digital citizens. And that means using tech for good, for digging for knowledge, not for harassment. If we don't have them do it positively, it will end up being used negatively. There's an awful lot at stake.
Well, the book is Addicted to Reform, a 12-step program to rescue public education, and its author is the John Merrow. John, as we like to say here, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you very much for the privilege, Tim. I appreciate it.
She's been a public school teacher. She's been a college professor. She's a dairy farmer, and she is the senator from the 31st District in Wisconsin. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Kathleen Vinehout.
Good to be here.
So check this out. I'm hearing stories, words. There's something grumbling about learning and freedom and stuff, something coming out of the Vinehout office. Give us some more detail.
This week, I am very pleased to be able to introduce a bill that would provide free tuition for all Wisconsin residents to our 2-year UW campuses and our technical colleges. This is a dream of mine to make this happen. It's actually the second time that I've introduced a bill like this, but what's happened is that many other states have taken the lead, Tim, and shown us how to create a bill that really helps students and helps drop away the barrier or the obstacle that finances can be to getting into the door of higher education.
So when we look at this, and you're talking about 2-year associate degree schools, tuition free, that means residents of Wisconsin?
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm now looking at like Black Hawk Technical College for my associate's degree in auto mechanics. Does that qualify?
Absolutely, yes.
Wow. So if there's an auto mechanics employer in the area, then this might be a boom for them.
Absolutely. I have been around the state listening to businesses talk about what they need to have in order to grow. And I hear over and over again, we need a skilled workforce. We don't have the people that we need to be able to expand our business. So this is a win for businesses, and it's a win for anybody that's in a job that says, hey, I don't really like this job anymore. I want to do something different. I want to take up a new opportunity, or I want to follow my dream.
Well, so when I want to follow my dream, I mean, so I'm looking at some of the statistics here, going back to what you talked about, a skilled workforce. And in fact, we're hearing in Wisconsin an interesting kind of cry from employers saying, we don't have the skilled workforce we need.
Absolutely. And there have been many studies going back. One of the studies I found went all the way back to 2009 that looked at the workforce and looked at what we needed up until 2020. This was a study that was done by the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, which is sometimes called COWS. And the study showed that Wisconsin was lacking in what they called the middle skills of people. So the people that maybe graduated from high school, but they had additional training. They went to an associate, got an associate degree, they got a certificate, they went back and got a certain skill that they needed, and that opened doors for them to have a job that they liked. And these are the kinds of needs for employers, and it's an area where Wisconsin is not keeping up with what the demand is out there.
So one of the questions I'm sure is going to be, okay, Kathleen, nothing is for free. So if nothing is for free, and if that's true, and I'm going to college, who's actually going to pick up, well, not me now, because I've taken my terminal degree and I'm just about terminal now. But if my son wants to take advantage of this, I mean, who's really paying?
I'm so glad that you asked that question.
Okay.
I have figured out exactly how much money this is going to cost. I'm projecting what we think is we're going to be able to add in terms of new people coming in and that maybe hadn't enrolled before. And I have a funding source that will cover the entire plan moving forward. And to understand where this money is coming from, it's helpful to know that the state of Wisconsin offers businesses and manufacturers many different types of tax credits. When I look at the tax credits claimed last year by business, there were 43 different types of tax credits. And now since then, we've had a 44th with the big Foxconn deal. Mm. I took one of those tax credits called the Ag and Manufacturing Tax Credit, and I took a part of it. I took the manufacturing part of it, so I didn't even take the whole thing. And that tax credit just about covers the total cost of what I expect this program would cost going forward. So we're projecting between $325 and $350 million, and that's roughly what the tax credit brings in right now. And when I look at the money that the manufacturers are able to get, and this is a pretty good-sized tax credit for a lot of manufacturers, and it in some cases it takes their taxes paid down to zero. But at the same time, these manufacturers are saying, we need skilled workers.
Okay.
So what a great trade-off. The businesses, the manufacturers say, we're pitching in this money, and the people say, now we have an opportunity to get an education that we didn't think we could get before, and we got the skills, and we'll go fill those jobs the manufacturers are looking to fill.
So I like how this comes across, because I know always there's a criticism whenever we say free, and that's why I put it out there that somebody has to pay for it, and you are paying for it. But,
absolutely.
Right. But we're saying, though, is that based on the need, particularly manufacturers, the need for this skilled workforce, is this a trade-off? Maybe trade-off's not even the best thing to say, but is this a way for you to, in one sense, help grow your own employees by giving you know, back this tax credit to allow people to become the skilled workforce that they need.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you look at what's happening in the economy right now, everybody that's listened to the news has heard corporate profits and corporate cash reserves are at an all-time high. The stock market's at an all-time high because that cash doesn't have any place else to go. At the same time, wages are stagnant. Wisconsin has a wage problem, Tim. We're 18th worst in the country in terms of wages and salaries. We're lower than Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Georgia. All these other states have employees with higher wages. Well, how do we gain better wages? One of the best ways to have more money in your paycheck is to get an education and get a better job. And that's what this bill would do, is provide that opportunity to get an education and to get a better job so you've got more money in your pocket. And what a great trade-off for the manufacturers who are looking for people who can't expand because they don't have the people to say, hey, I'm going to do my part. I'm going to help educate these people, and then I'm going to hire them, and I'm going to grow, and they're going to grow with me.
Wow. Talk about a breath of fresh air, this idea of mutually helping each other, both workers and the workplace and the manufacturers and the colleges. I mean, that's the way the system is supposed to work. So, Senator Vinehout, the name of this bill, though, we played with it as we introduced it, but this is the Freedom to Learn bill, you're calling it, or act.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So Freedom to Learn, Wisconsin, you've introduced it, and there's going to be more to come. And also, just to make sure that we announce this, you're also running for governor of the state of Wisconsin, correct?
That's correct. And I will point out, Tim, that this was an idea that I had back in 2013. I actually introduced it in 2013. We've had a lot of changes around the country since then. In 2014, Tennessee became the national leader in eliminating tuition and fees for incoming full-time students. And then since then, a lot of other states have joined this idea. California was one of the most recent states. But this bill that I'm introducing is broader even than Tennessee's, because it applies to every Wisconsin resident. And that Wisconsin resident has an opportunity to get into college even if they're going to go part-time, even if they can only take one class a semester. And this is a very different approach than other states are taking. And I very much feel strongly that people that want to go back when they're 37 or 43 or 52, they ought to be able to go back to school. It shouldn't be a barrier. I believe in lifelong learning, and I believe that if you really want that job and you really want to become that person that has that new job, go for it. And let's not let finances be a barrier.
Okay, I love it. What do I do? I'm a citizen. What should I be doing?
I would suggest that you call your senators and representatives and or send them an email and say, please sign on as a co-sponsor to Senator Vinehout's bill called Freedom to Learn. I can think of lots of opportunities that people that I know that could take advantage of this, and I want you to sign on to this bill and to get a hearing and to get it passed.
Well, there it is. Busted Pencils listeners, you now have homework. Get out that phone, get out that email, get out that Twitter. All of your representatives, your senators, get on them, because Freedom to Learn, I love that too, because we all, I mean, that's just a human right, the freedom to learn, and then the practicality of truly having a free way to learn. Man, Senator Vinehout, you have truly busted pencils.
Time to enter Cone Zone with education author and activist Alfie Cone.
So, Alfie, standardized tests are bad, but what about regular tests?
They're not much better in many cases. We've had research for many years showing that the best teachers, by various criteria, rarely, if ever, give their kids tests. And that's the case, first of all, because tests tend to measure what matters least. Tests of all sorts are mostly about tapping how many forgettable facts have been shoved into short-term memory. There are much richer forms of assessment to let us get a sense of what kids actually know and can do with what they know. And the other reason teachers, the best teachers, rarely give tests, even of their own creation, is that they don't need to. Because if the room has been set up for thinking as opposed to mere listening, then the teacher is getting a constant stream of information about who gets what and who needs help. And so it would be ridiculous to draw a line under the learning, say, take everything off your desk, and now I'm just going to test you. The teacher already knows what matters.
But I'm a parent, right? And I want to know how my child is doing, and the way that's communicated is through tests.
Well, no. The way that's communicated, worse, is through grades right now, as opposed to narrative reports or conversations. But the question is, what information leads the teacher to draw the conclusion in bad reports like report cards or good reports of a qualitative nature? And the answer is, there are many exhibitions of mastery, as the Coalition of Essential Schools put it, many portfolios, many performance assessments. There's a whole shelf in the library on authentic assessment that helps teachers gather the information they need in order to check with the kids and their parents and provide much more useful and constructive information on which to base an evaluation than a test could ever provide.
Is the problem here, and because I've heard you use the word assessment and test, do too many people think the two are the same?
Oh, yes. In fact, now teachers just try to dress it up and use assessment as a euphemism when they just mean tests. But of course, tests are just one of many possible ways to learn what kids know, and by the way, to learn how effective the teacher has been, which is what assessment is really telling us whether we choose to admit that or not. Testing is just one inferior tool, and the best teachers have discovered that it can often be dispensed with entirely all the way up through school.
But then we'd have to actually have a sense of understanding all these different forms of assessment. I think you mentioned some portfolio exhibitions, and I'm, you know, are we there?
Well, as a field, we are.
Okay.
Some individual teachers need help and coaching from administrators and so on to learn how to get information about kids' learning without using tests. And by the way, tests also have the potential to undermine students' goals and the way they approach learning. The more a kid is led to focus on how he or she is going to do on an upcoming test, the less likely that kid is to plunge into a story or engage fully with a project or experiment. Learning to pass a test is qualitatively different from learning for its own sake. So getting rid of tests isn't sufficient for creating a true, deep, student-centered learning classroom, but I think it's necessary.
Time now for our weekly tribute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zinn.
But I suppose the most revolutionary act one can engage in is to tell the truth.
My thanks to John Merrow, Senator Kathleen Vinehout, Matt Damon's mom, Alfie Cohn, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.